Chapter 39. Her stroke. She merely looked paler, with darker shadows in the folds and recesses of her obesity, and, in the fluted mob cap tied by a starched bow between her first two chins, and the muslin kerchief crossed over her billowing purple dressing gown, she seemed like some shrewd and kindly ancestress of her own who might have yielded too freely to the pleasures of the table. She held out one of the little hands that nestled in the hollow of her huge lap like pet animals, and called to the maid. "Aunt, let in anyone else. If my daughters call, say I'm asleep." The maid disappeared, and the old lady turned to her grandson. "My dear, am I perfectly hideous?" she asked gaily, launching out one hand in search of the folds of muslin on her inaccessible bosom. "Why, daughters tell me it doesn't matter at my age, as if hideousness didn't matter all the more the harder it gets to conceal." "My dear, you're handsomer than ever," Archer rejoined in the same tone, and she threw back her head and laughed. "Ah, but not as handsome as Ellen," she jerked out, twinkling at him maliciously, and before he could answer she added, "as she so awfully handsome the day you drove her up from the ferry?" He laughed, and she continued, "as it because you told her, so that as he had to put you out on the way? In my youth young men didn't desert pretty women, unless they were made to." She gave another chuckle, and interrupted it to say almost querulously, "'Tis a pity she didn't marry you, I always told her so. It would have spared me all this worry. But whoever thought of sparing their grandmother worry?" Archer wondered if her illness had blurred her faculties, but suddenly she broke out. "Well, it's settled, anyhow. She's going to stay with me, whatever the rest of the family say. As he hadn't been here 5 minutes before I'd have gone down on my knees, to keep her if only, for the last 20 years, I'd been able to see where the floor was." Archer listened in silence, and she went on. "Hey, it talked me over, as no doubt you know. Persuaded me, Lovell, and Letter Blair, and Augusta Welland, and all the rest of them, that I must hold out and cut off her allowance, till she was made to see that it was her duty to go back to Olensky. They thought they'd convinced me when the secretary, or whatever he was, came out with the last proposals. Handsome proposals, I confess they were. After all, marriage is marriage, and money's money, both useful things in their way. And I didn't know what to answer." She broke off, and drew a long breath, as if speaking had become an effort. "At the minute I laid eyes on her, I said, 'Back, quote, why, oh, you sweet bird, you. Shut you up in that cage again? Never.' Apostrophe, and now it's settled that she's to stay here and nurse her granny, as long as there's a granny to nurse. It's not a gay prospect, but she doesn't mind. And of course I've told Letter Blair that she's to be given her proper allowance." The young man heard her with veins aglow, but in his confusion of mind he hardly knew whether her news brought joy or pain. He had so definitely decided on the course he meant to pursue that for the moment he could not readjust his thoughts. But gradually there stole over him the delicious sense of difficulties deferred and opportunities miraculously provided. If Ellen had consented to come and live with her grandmother, it must surely be because he had recognized the impossibility of giving him up. This was her answer to his final appeal of the other day. If she would not take the extreme step he had urged, he had at last yielded to half measures. He sank back into the thought with the involuntary relief of a man who has been ready to risk everything, and suddenly tastes the dangerous sweetness of security. "She couldn't have gone back, it was impossible," he exclaimed. "Ah, my dear, I always knew you were on her side, and that's why I sent for you today, and why I said to your pretty wife, when she proposed to come with you, 'Back, quote, no, my dear, I'm pining to see Newland, and I don't want anybody to share our transports.' Apostrophe, apostrophe, for you see, my dear," she drew her head back as far as its tethering chins permitted, and looked him full in the eyes, "Oosie, we shall have a fight yet. The family don't want her here, and they'll say it's because I've been ill, because I'm a weak old woman, that she's persuaded me. I'm not well enough yet to fight them one by one, and you've got to do it for me. I, he stammered. You? Why not? She jerked back at him, her round eyes suddenly as sharp as penknives. Her hand fluttered from its chair arm, and lit on his with a clutch of little pale nails like bird claws. Why not? She searchingly repeated. Archer, under the exposure of her gaze, had recovered his self-possession. Oh, I don't count I'm too insignificant. Well, you're Letter Blair's partner, ain't you? You've got to get at them through Letter Blair. Unless you've got a reason, she insisted. Oh, my dear, I back you to hold your own against them all without my help. But you shall have it, if you need it, he reassured her. Then we're safe, she sighed. And smiling on him with all her ancient cunning she added, as she settled her head among the cushions. Always knew you'd back us up, because they never quote you, when they talk about it's being her duty to go home. He winced a little at her terrifying perspicacity, and longed to ask. And he may do they quote her? But he judged it safer to turn the question. And Madame Olenska? When am I to see her? He said. The old lady chuckled, crumpled her lids, and went through the pantomime of archness. Ah, today. One at a time, please. Madame Olenska's gone out. He flushed with disappointment, and she went on. She's gone out, my child. Gone in my carriage to see Regina Beaufort. She paused for this announcement to produce its effect. That's what she's reduced me to already. The day after she got here she put on her best bonnet, and told me, as cool as a cucumber, that she was going to call on Regina Beaufort. Back quote I don't know her, who is she? Apostrophe apostrophe says one. Back quote she apostrophe is your grandniece, and a most unhappy woman, apostrophe she says. Back quote she apostrophe is the wife of a scoundrel, apostrophe I answered. Back quote WELL, apostrophe she says, back quote AND so am I, and yet all my family want me to go back to him. Apostrophe apostrophe well, that floored me, and I let her go, and finally one day she said it was raining too hard to go out on foot, and she wanted me to lend her my carriage. Back quote WHAT4? Apostrophe I asked her, and she said. Back quote T.O. go and see cousin Regina cousin. Now, my dear, I looked out of the window, and saw it wasn't raining a drop, but I understood her, and I let her have the carriage. ... After all, Regina's a brave woman, and so is she, and I've always liked courage above everything. Archer bent down, and pressed his lips on the little hand, that still lay on his. Whose hand did you think you were kissing, young man? Your wife's, I hope, the old lady snapped out with her mocking cackle, and as he rose to go she called out after him. I've heard her granny's love, but you'd better not say anything about our talk. XXXI. Archer had been stunned by old Catherine's news. It was only natural that Madame Olenska should have hastened from Washington in response to her grandmother's summons. But that she should have decided to remain under her roof, especially now that Mrs. Mingott had almost regained her health, was less easy to explain. Archer was sure that Madame Olenska's decision had not been influenced by the change in her financial situation. He knew the exact figure of the small income which her husband had allowed her at their separation. Without the addition of her grandmother's allowance it was hardly enough to live on, in any sense known to the Mingott vocabulary. And now that Medora Manson, who shared her life, had been ruined, such a pittance would barely keep the two women clothed and fed. Yet Archer was convinced that Madame Olenska had not accepted her grandmother's offer from interested motives. As he had the heedless generosity, and the spasmodic extravagance of persons used to large fortunes, and indifferent to money, but she could go without many things which her relations considered indispensable, and Mrs. Lovell Mingott and Mrs. Welland had often been heard to deplore that anyone who had enjoyed the cosmopolitan luxuries of Count Olenski's establishments should care so little about how things were done. Moreover, as Archer knew, several months had passed since her allowance had been cut off. Yet in the interval S.E. had made no effort to regain her grandmother's favor. Therefore if S.E. had changed her course, it must be for a different reason. He did not have far to seek for that reason. On the way from the ferry, S.E. had told him that he and she must remain apart, but S.E. had said it with her head on his breast. He knew that there was no calculated coquetry in her words. She was fighting her fate as he had fought his, and clinging desperately to her resolve that they should not break faith with the people who trusted them. But during the 10 days which had elapsed since her return to New York, S.E. had perhaps guessed from his silence, and from the fact of his making no attempt to see her, that he was meditating a decisive step, a step from which there was no turning back. At the thought, a sudden fear of her own weakness might have seized her, and she might have felt that, after all, it was better to accept the compromise usual in such cases, and follow the line of least resistance. An hour earlier, when he had rung Mrs. Mingott's bell, Archer had fancied that his path was clear before him. He had meant to have a word alone with Madame Olenska, and failing that, to learn from her grandmother on what day, and by which train, she was returning to Washington. In that train he intended to join her, and travel with her to Washington, or as much farther as she was willing to go. His own fancy inclined to Japan. At any rate she would understand at once that, wherever she went, he was going. He meant to leave a note for May that should cut off any other alternative. He had fancied himself not only nerved for this plunge, but eager to take it. Yet his first feeling on hearing that the course of events was changed had been one of relief. Now, however, as he walked home from Mrs. Mingott's, he was conscious of a growing distaste for what lay before him. There was nothing unknown or unfamiliar in the path he was presumably to tread. But when he had trodden it before, it was as a free man, who was accountable to no one for his actions, and could lend himself with an amused detachment to the game of precautions and prevarications, concealments and compliances, that the part required. This procedure was called protecting a woman's honor, and the best fiction, combined with the after-dinner talk of his elders, had long since initiated him into every detail of its code. Now he saw the matter in a new light, and his part in it seemed singularly diminished. It was, in fact, that which, with a secret fatuity, he had watched Mrs. Thorley Rushworth play toward a fond and unperceiving husband. A smiling, bantering, humoring, watchful and incessant lie. A lie by day, a lie by night, a lie in every touch and every look, a lie in every caress and every quarrel, a lie in every word and in every silence. It was easier, and less dastardly on the whole, for a wife to play such a part toward her husband. A woman's standard of truthfulness was tacitly held to be lower. She was the subject creature, and versed in the arts of the enslaved. Then she could always plead moods and nerves, and the right not to be held too strictly to account, and even in the most straight-laced societies the laugh was always against the husband. But in Archer's little world no one laughed at a wife deceived, and a certain measure of contempt was attached to men who continued their philandering after marriage. In the rotation of crops there was a recognized season for wild oats, but they were not to be sown more than once. Archer had always shared this view. In his heart he thought Lefferts despicable. But to love Ellen Olenska was not to become a man like Lefferts. For the first time Archer found himself face to face with the dread argument of the individual case. Ellen Olenska was like no other woman, he was like no other man. Their situation, therefore, resembled no one else's, and they were answerable to no tribunal, but that of their own judgment. Yes, but in 10 minutes more he would be mounting his own doorstep, and there were May, and habit, and honor, and all the old decencies that he and his people had always believed in. At his corner he hesitated, and then walked on down Fifth Avenue. Ahead of him, in the winter night, loomed a big unlit Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.